Oh dear. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Guess what I'm talking about. As most of you know, I'm currently doing teaching at university, and whenever I'm telling the students, you know, to answer assignments, I always say to them, you know, a good place to start is to define your key terms. And really what I'm saying to them is, I'm fed up of looking at work which they start rambling and clearly don't know what they're talking about. And if I could at least encourage them to look up the definition for the main topics, then it would at least put a thought in their head that this is really what we want you to talk about, and it should flow naturally then from that. I struggle in vain at times, but nonetheless, it's very common that we find that whenever we're looking at these things, we tend to think about definitions on key terms. And whenever we think about what's the definition of faith, this is the one which always, to my mind, always springs to mind. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. I've got to say that if one of my students gave me that definition or that style of definition, I would have to mark it down and say, I don't understand what you mean. You know, a definition is supposed to make clear. And to me, as a definition, you know, it's stuck at the front of chapter 11, and we call Hebrews 11 the faith chapter. And certainly it goes on to tell us an awful lot about examples of faith. But as a definition, you're left struggling. What does it mean? And as a consequence of that, a lot of us go through life and we come across a lot of concepts that people talk about faith, and you wonder, you know, what the grounding is for what they mean. Most people see faith as, through this definition, as some kind of ethereal type topic or subject. It's about belief in stuff we don't understand. That's faith. It's mystical. Is that how the Bible, though, expresses faith? It's not. It isn't. I want to start off with just staying in Hebrews, because I think it's right in this instance to stay in Hebrews, because that, we need to see that within a broader context. But the one that I want to go to starts a good bit before it. I'm not going afterwards in Hebrews, I'm going before. Hebrews chapter 3, beginning in verse 16. Now, he's talking, the writer of the book of Hebrews is talking here about Israel and how they were sent into the, or going into the promised land. And when they went into the promised land, well, I'll read this bit first and then we'll go into the backstory of it. Hebrews 3, verse 16. Who were they who heard and rebelled? Were they not all those Moses led out of Egypt? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies perished in the wilderness, and to whom did God swear that they would never enter his rest, if not to those who disobeyed? So we see that they were not able to enter because of their unbelief. Right? Hebrews 4, verse 1. Therefore, Since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the good news proclaimed to us, just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them because they did not share the faith of those who obeyed. Right? Now, just going into the backstory here. These were people, Israel, having been brought out of Egypt, they had seen many miracles of God. They had witnessed the plagues that were brought upon Egypt. They were party to the discussion and the debate between Moses and Pharaoh. They had to, you know, because these were not things that happened on the side that they were somehow victims of. It wasn't that Moses was just a self-appointed or even God-appointed leader without their involvement. Because at each stage, if we remember in particular the Passover, they were intimately involved in everything that happened in relation to that. So they were fully party to all of this. It's not as if they were just innocent bystanders. So they experienced these miracles. And as they left Egypt, for all the trouble that had been caused, they were showered with treasures and blessings by the Egyptians, who by this time were probably glad to see the back of them, to be honest. But they were given all these treasures and gold and jewellery to take with them. But as they left, they then saw Pharaoh's army pursuing them. And they felt afraid of their life, for their life. But as they travelled, they had the pillar of smoke, they had the fire, you know, they had all of these things that were leading them. They were conscious and aware of the presence of God. They passed through the sea on dry land. They saw the miracle. They saw the Egyptian army founder and fall as the sea closed in on them. They knew of God's deliverance. These are those same people that we're talking about here, looking back at this from Hebrews. And at the entrance to the promised land, Moses had said, right, let's see what we're getting into. I want a representative of each tribe to go in and spy out the land and see what we're getting, see what God is giving us. And these 12 witnesses came back and they fell into two camps, as you know. 10 of them said they acknowledged a land of milk and honey, absolutely. But places full of giants. And they kept, you know, they rhymed off the people that lived there, the Hittites and all the rest of it, you know, and you can think, you know, fearsome people. People that are well and truly entrenched, encamped, not going to be easy to shift. And the 10 witnesses that took that, were taking that side, were saying, we've spent all our lives as slaves. We're not soldiers. We don't have one sword or spear between us. And we're going to go in and push this lot out. Forget it. It's just not going to happen. It's, you know, God's brought us here to kill us. But notice the acknowledgement. God has brought us here. Why didn't he just leave us back in Egypt where life was lovely? Wasn't it? Really. I mean, compared to what's in front of us, that was good. And then there was two witnesses. just two against the ten, who said, hang on a minute. Who says anything about us taking the land? God said he's going to give it to us. I say we believe God and we let him give us the land. I don't think we're meant to fight. I don't think we're meant to be soldiers. I think we should trust God. So they held a vote. And they decided we're not going in. And God said, fine, then you're not going to go in for 40 more years. And by the time you're ready to go in, none of those who've said that they're not wanting to go in are going to be around to do so. Only those two witnesses remained alive at the end of those 40 years. Everybody that was 20 years and above at that point in time otherwise died in the wilderness. But you notice what Hebrews says. It talks about them believing and not believing. And it then goes on to say they did not share the faith of those who obeyed. That leads you into a deeper understanding of this concept of faith. Faith is tied to belief. It's what you believe in and what you're prepared to do, think, act, and see because of that belief. In other words, faith is belief in action. Little analogy for you. You're winter's day, and to get home, you've got to go over a river that's frozen over. How much faith does it take to go on that river over the ice? Now, if that ice is very, very thin, right, does it take a lot of faith to go onto it or a little faith? You might say it takes a lot of faith. And that's generally what we see, isn't it? When you see somebody getting into an old banger, you say, my, you must have a lot of faith driving that. And that's because they appear to be exercising a belief that somehow or other this will get them where they want to go that runs contrary to the evidence of our eyes. So we say that they must have great faith. If I go out with great faith onto thin ice, what is it that's likely to happen? I'm liable to fall through the ice. By faith, I sink. My faith sinks me, right? If, however, that ice is thick, it's solid, but I come up to it and I'm trepidation and fear, I don't know, still don't trust it. So tie a big rope round about myself, tie it to a tree, just in case I do go under, I can pull myself out, write a note to Annette, just, you know, if anything happens to me, if I'm not home for dinner, I'm under the ice, you know, dinner's in the fridge, sorry. And you go out, you know, on all fours and you go across the ice. Now, what's likely to happen? I'm going to get across okay, aren't I? Now, you're going to say, well, but your faith really had nothing to do with it. Thin ice, thick ice, that's what it was all about. It's a lot to do with our attitude in approaching it. That is where the faith comes into it. Another analogy for you. If you can imagine three people sitting on an aeroplane. Right? One, an old lady who's never ever flown in her life before. Then in the middle, someone who perhaps never flown before, but younger and has been fascinated by aeroplanes and all the rest of it. And they're just sort of sitting there, a little bit anxious perhaps, but hey-ho, it's an adventure. And then you've got the seasoned businessman who basically flies every week, and he's sitting there just reading his newspaper. You know, that little old lady, absolutely frightened to death. Her family had emigrated, grandsons have been born, and if it wasn't for the fact that this was her only chance to see them, there is no way that she would risk her life on this plane. That's her view of life. How much faith has she got? She's got just a minuscule amount of faith. She basically is waiting for the plane to crash every minute it is flying. She can never relax from the moment it takes off until it's landed and stopped. That's it. She is petrified. She's living on her nerves. The young lad, as soon as that's up in the air, the initial butterflies settle down. And, oh, this is okay. I wish I had the window seat. I'd be able to see a bit more of what's going on out there. Isn't that great? This is brilliant. And they're looking out and maybe saying to the old lady, look how the wings go up and down. Isn't that amazing? And like, shut up, don't say a thing. You know? And she's probably sitting there praying the whole way. And all the time, the businessman's sitting there, I wish these pair would shut up, you know. You go back to sleep, you know. Not a care in the world. And when they land, businessman, refreshed, ready to go for the day's work, the young lad, he's had a wee bit of excitement. You know, it's been good, but a bit tiring. But, you know, that's great. I wish I could go again. I wish I was flying back again just for the experience. And a little old lady is probably going to take her a month to recover. You know, and what joy is she going to have in visiting the grandkids? All of those had sufficient faith to take that flight. One had very, very little faith. One had medium amount of faith. And the other one had enormous faith. And guess what? They all started together. And they all finished together at exactly the same time. The difference in faith between them did not make one iota of difference to the time that it took them to complete the journey. There's a Luke 17. Now. I've gone and put this. Luke 17. Verse 1. Luke 17 and verse 1. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. He said to his disciples, things that cause people to sin are bound to come, but woe to that person through whom they come. Verse 2. It would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a millstone tied around his neck than for him to cause one of these little ones to sin. Verse 3. So watch yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. If he sins against you seven times in a day, and seven times comes back to you and says, I repent, forgive him. Now, think about the culture at that time. Think about somebody wronging you repeatedly. This is a big ask. This is an enormous ask. Verse 5. The apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. What they're saying is, that amount of forgiveness, I need an awful lot of faith to do that. That is a big ask. An awful lot of forgiveness. So, Lord, increase our faith. Allow us to see that person the way you do. They think that that's a measure of faith. Verse 6. He replied, "If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and planted in the sea,' and it will obey you." Now, what's Jesus saying here? On the one hand, they're saying, increase our faith. And Jesus is saying, if your faith is as small as a mustard seed. The mustard seed was the smallest seed known in the world at that time. You know, you could get thousands upon thousands of them in the palm of your hand. Thousands of these seeds. And Jesus says, if your faith is as small as that, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Now, this brings us to another aspect of faith. Because if faith and belief are connected, now it's one thing for me to say I can have faith in the ice because if it's nice and thick it will support me. And as I said, that's not really about faith, is it? Except in as much as it affects, it influences our attitude to it. Flying, it influences our attitude to the flying. Are you able to relax during the flight? Yes or no? If your faith is great, yes. If your faith is small, then no. You're always on tenterhooks waiting to crash and burn. But what is your faith expressed in? On the one hand, that faith is about the ice, and on the other hand, the faith is about the aeroplane. You trust that the maintenance people have done their work on it, and to the extent that you believe, you know. The thing is, you see, we all see the statistics. And if you were flying every day of your life, statistically speaking, you could fly right through until you were over 5,000 years old before you were killed by an aircraft. Of course, statistics also plays the other game, and you could be unlucky, and the flight that crashes is the first one that you're on. That's the thing about statistics. So what we say is that, you know, there's only so many crashes that happen. It's just a minuscule amount. It's a very, very few. So it's very, very safe. It's not safe to those who experience the crash that forms those statistics. And that's always what's at the back of your mind in spite of everything else at times, especially when there's one in the news at the moment, you know. It tends to be in your mind, do I really want to get on an aeroplane at this point in time? Well, a positive way of looking at it is, as hard as it is for those people and for their families, the statistics are settled for another little while.
At any one second in a day, there are a million people up in the air.
Yes, any one second in a day, a million people up in the air. And most of them, the vast majority of them, come back down again. And that, if you want to play statistics, that's what we are saying. But in these instances, the object of our faith is the ice or the plane. This is the thing, you see, we express faith in an object or in a person. When Jesus says this, is he expressing faith in the mulberry bush? The mulberry bush is incapable. It's not in its physical makeup to be able to uproot itself and be repositioned into the sea. It's an impossibility, physically. So he's not talking here about faith in an object. I think he's been very clever in the way that he's put it across, because, you know, you're looking at it and you're saying, well, what is my faith? Where is my belief centred that allows me to express with conviction that an instruction like that might be carried out? And he's talking, of course, about our faith in him, our belief in Jesus Christ. Do you know Jesus Christ? I don't mean, do you know of Jesus Christ? I mean, do you know Jesus Christ? Do you know Jesus Christ like you know your brother or sister? Do you know Jesus Christ like your best friend? Because I can say on occasion, but on occasion I get it wrong, that under a certain circumstance, I can trust or have faith that Annette may act in a certain way. Of course, as soon as I say that, she would say, no, I don't. I wouldn't do that. But you, when you know a person, when you believe in a person and know them well, then you can imagine that under certain circumstances, you know how they might act and react. And the better you know them, the more accurate that picture is going to be. So the better we know Jesus Christ, the better we know how he will act. Because why am I saying that? Because how many people have tried this? I want you to be honest. How many people have looked at a tree and prayed, Lord, you know, it would be ever so nice, it would be lovely if I could have that proof of your existence and your being. Look, you've made this promise in Scripture, haven't you, Lord? This is a promise in Scripture, isn't it? I will pray and I will have faith, Lord, that this tree in front of me is going to be uprooted and planted in the sea. It may not be a tree, it may be a mountain being moved or something, but come on, be honest, how many of you have done it? One. There's one honest person. I've done it. And you know, you sort of say to yourself at the end of it, you think, well, that was stupid. But how do I feel now? Does that mean that I don't have faith? Does that mean that, you know, I've got a problem with faith? And this is where, you see, if we don't understand this concept, it's easy to think into, because there's little bits in the Bible where you say, well, this means I can do this, this means I can do that. And you see them as promises, don't you? You see them as evidence. Surely, if I pray for that, then that's got to happen. Because it tells me, I'll give you another one. Psalm 37 and verse 4. Wonderful. Psalm 37 and verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing to see expressed in faith? Dear Father, I could really do with winning the lottery tonight. Is that going to happen? Does it mean that my faith is small if that doesn't happen? See, the thing is,
I believed it.
you're just looking for a share. Right. The thing is, you see, if I can get you all praying for it, maybe it will become true. Maybe if we can get 1,000 other people praying for it. Maybe if we put it on Facebook or on Twitter, and get everybody to share it. If a million people share it, maybe it'll come true. Is this ringing bells with you? Do you see these things going around? I keep tripping over them. You know, please share this thing because, you know, this will make a big difference to somebody's life, etc. You know, there's an expression, a sort of wish list faith there, isn't there? And this is where I'm saying, you know, whenever I first said that, a lot of you have said, oh, no, 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 that's not how we think about faith. But isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think we can all be infected to that degree, just that little bit. So if that doesn't mean that, what can that mean? See, the thing is, the more you know Jesus Christ, if you develop a relationship with Jesus Christ, the other thing about Scripture it tells us is that, you know, Paul tells us, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Right? So, in actual fact, I'm going to be bold here and say that there's a bit of a cheat here on God's part. Because that doesn't quite mean exactly what we would think humanly it means. Because our desire is to win the lottery, be wealthy, be healthy, be happy. Right? And let's face it, there's a whole religion out there based on that called the health, wealth and prosperity gospel. Name it and claim it. You know, it's there. And this Bible, this promise exists in the Bible. This is a biblical promise. That's not a promise. That is not a promise. What is it? It's a statement of fact. It's a statement of truth. Delight yourself in the Lord. How do you delight yourself in the Lord?
Prayer and reading the Bible.
Prayer and reading the Bible. How do you delight yourself in your best friend? You spend time with them. How do you delight yourself with your spouse? You spend time with them. In other words, you develop the intimacy of that relationship. You get to know them. And guess what happens then? Do I really think that Annette wants an iMac laptop for her birthday? I know the answer to that is no. But she might suspect that I might want one. Now, what am I saying here? If I'm going to buy her a present for her birthday, am I going to get subliminally that what I want for myself? Or am I going to try and please her? Am I going to read her heart and try to please her? To the extent I delight myself in her as my wife, then you would all like to think, but you don't know me that well. No. Of course, I'm going to do that thing which I'm looking to please her.
So it'll be a set of saucepans.
That'll be a set of saucepans, absolutely. Because otherwise, how can she best cook my dinner for me? See, the thing here is, delight yourself in the Lord. That is a precondition. That is a precondition to this. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. But guess what happens in between? He influences the desires of your heart. Because as Paul says, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. So guess whose desires are planted in my heart? Christ's desires. We know about this from another thing. When it says, pray in accordance with God's will. Not my will be done, Lord, but yours. And what that is saying is exactly the same thing. God's will be done. Absolutely. He created all of this. We are in all of this. Faith is based on belief. Our belief is based on our knowledge and understanding and our relationship with God. faith, then, coming full circle, is our actions in the light of our belief in God. If God plants on our heart that that tree should be lifted from there to go into there, number one, he might give you a shovel. Or he may just answer your prayer. But if it is in his will, then how much faith do you need? Very, very little, because it's not you that's doing it. It is Jesus Christ. That little faith expressed in the aeroplane, enough to get onto it for that old lady. Just enough to say, I'm going to risk my life. I'm going to do it. Right? That person, even although the ice is very, very thick, but minuscule amount of faith allows them to try it, allows them to walk out onto it. Ever so filled with fear that it's going to crack and break at any moment, but nonetheless, enough to go out there. Therefore, enough to see them over. Enough to see the lady visiting her grandkids. That is the expression of faith. You don't need, it's not about how much faith you've got, because you don't need a lot of faith. What you need to be sure of is that your faith is in the right person, the right object, and that it's founded on the right foundation. Belief is expressed in understanding and knowledge. If I know, if I've got every reason to believe that that ice is nice and thick, I can go across it confidently. I can express a lot of faith in what I'm doing. But I don't need that amount of faith to get me over. I just need enough to try it. That's the important thing. And that's all that Jesus is saying when he's talking to the disciples. He's telling them, you don't understand. You're asking for more faith. Just have enough to trust me. Just have enough to put your life in my hands. Rest in that, and I will take care of the rest. And that was exactly the position as well Israel faced. You know, because we would all say that if we were in that position, we would have been with the two witnesses. Would you? Really? When you saw what they all saw? No, they expressed enormous faith, those two. The other 10, they were human. And as I look around you and as I look in a mirror back at me, what I see is human. You know? And what I give thanks for is that through Jesus Christ, I know that my humanity is being corrected and addressed. And my faith, therefore, is not misplaced in Jesus Christ, and nor is yours. But when we talk about faith, let's understand that it's not some mysterious concept. Just check. Every time you use that phrase, every time you use that expression, you know, I need more faith, or it's an expression of faith, just think about, are you applying it correctly? Because bear in mind, we can all innocently lead other people into that level of mistruth, because you can innocently reinforce concepts and beliefs, even although, you know, in your mind, you know that that's not the case. To the extent that you repeat it, you condone it, and you reinforce and affirm other people's mistaken beliefs. So, you know, let's have a think about our faith and where it's placed and where it's best placed. Thank you.